promote their own knockoff brands. Amazon has called the reporting, quote, incorrect and unsubstantiated. Weather in Washington, D.C. right now is a cool 71 degrees and sunny. In New York City, it's 64 degrees and also sunny. For WPFW in Washington and WBAI in New York, I'm Amara Evering.
This is WBAI New York, 99.5 FM and WBAI.org online. Stay tuned for Black Star News with Milton Alamadi. Coming up, it's 3 p.m.
Sisters and brothers, welcome to Black Star News Show on WBAI 99.5 FM radio, also streaming on WBAI.org. I am your host, Milton Alamadi. Welcome to today's Pan-African show. Today we are looking briefly at the life and legacy of Thomas Sankara, the great late leader of Burkina Faso, assassinated October 15, 1987. Here to help us remember how important and critical Thomas Sankara was to Africa and indeed to progressives all over the world and revolutionaries is Professor Naka Lagoke. He is at Lincoln University, Department of History, Political Science, and Philosophy. That, of course, is the alma mater of Kwame Nkrumah and Azikiwe, the late leaders of Ghana and Nigeria, respectively. Welcome to Black Star News Show, Professor Naka Lagoke.
So thank you very much, Milton, for the opportunity.
Okay, great. So let's get straight into it. Tell listeners who may not be familiar, who was Thomas Sankara and why was his life, even though he was in power only for a brief 4 years, why was his life so critical to the history of Africa?
Yeah, thank you very much for this very interesting and important question. I'm from the Ivory Coast. It's a French-speaking country. And then my land is a land of immigration, multiracial, multicultural. And then we've been welcoming since colonial times people coming from different parts of Africa, and particularly from Burkina Faso. So we are highly connected to Upper Volta, that was the name back then. And then one day, Thomas Sankara, we heard about a figure who was rising in Upper Volta politics, and his name was Thomas Sankara. He was full of life, energy, he has a vision for Africa. And then I was in high school, and like many millions of young people in Africa, we saw in him the person we were waiting for to give us a sense of hope when Mandela was in prison, and then Kwame Nkrumah and many other African founding fathers, were either gone, or some of them were not even doing the right thing. So Sankara, then, when he rose to power after a successful revolution in Burkina Faso, I saw in Ivory Coast how Ivorians who used to see people from Upper Volta as second-class citizens, how Thomas Sankara changed the perspective of my people. Towards the citizens of Volta. That was one thing that people need to know. So Thomas Sankara was he implemented a number of policies to empower women. He helped his people plant trees in order to fight against desertification, and then he reduced the budget of the state, and he really helped people build many different other things in different other sectors, giving increasing the literacy rate in the country, increasing the rate of vaccination of children, all the things Thomas Sankara did. And he was also a great advocate of the non-alignment movement. And Thomas Sankara was also, of course, a great Pan-Africanist who fought against the burden of African debt. And we need to know that he claimed the revolution of Fidel Castro, and then he promoted the sense of African collectivism. But in a decolonial act, he changed the name of his country from Upper Volta to Burkina Faso, the land of the upright men. So Burkina comes from that African collectivism in the Mori language, the language of the Musi, which is a Burkindi. Later on, I will find out that Burkindi is the Mori variation or variant of that Ubuntu philosophy that later on Mandela was going to promote, and which became today a very important theoretical framework that many people seem to be advocating and embracing. That was Thomas Sankara when he was in power. In 4 years, this is what some of the things that he did. Now, when he dies and then replaced, killed by Blaise Compaoré people and who implemented neo-colonial policies, Thomas Sankara, later on, his spirit, his vision, were going to be claimed by the citizens of Burkina Faso, who organized a people's power movement. And then this is how Blaise Compaoré was going to be taken out of power. Since then, his name has been engulfing in Africa and across the globe. And this is how he's been inspiring that people's power movement, like in different parts of Africa, in Mali, in Guinea, in Congo, and in Ivory Coast, in different parts. So this is what I can say about Thomas Sankara.
And how was he able to transform the perception of people in Côte d'Ivoire, in your country, toward the people of what was formerly Upper Volta, which had become Burkina Faso? How?
Yeah, because when Thomas Sankara was there, he was a man of integrity. So in Africa, we used to leaders who embezzled money. And then from Oufuette Boigny to Blaise Compaoré, who came later on, to, let's say, like Yoweri Museveni, and so all the Yadimas and then the Bongos, all those people, this is what we were used to. Sankara comes, and he lived a life of austerity. And then he did not use the money for selfish reason. Not even his family could even be, they could even ask him in order to get some particular privilege when Sankara was there. And then the values that he embodied, that the Burkindi value, that the value system that he embodied, love, sharing, the passion for Africa, to empower Africa, all those things made the people who somehow did not have a great respect for his people to see him like in different light, and to see his compatriots through him. This is how the perception of Ivorians changed towards the people of Burkina Faso, because of the values of Thomas Sankara, and because of his thoughts, because of his work, and because of his deeds and his actions.
So, Professor Lagoke, you know what you're saying. You're actually implying that if every African country had a leader of Thomas Sankara's caliber, then the global perception, or at least the perception in other African countries, toward Africa would change.
Yes, definitely. And it's a great question, Milton Alimadi, because I will talk quickly about Oufuette Boigny. Oufuette Boigny, the first president of Ivory Coast, he was the one who created the Union of African Families in 1944. And later on, he helped. It was the leader of what we call in French, Rassemblement Démocratique Africain, like an African Democratic Rally, if I can use that. Mm-hmm. So, and then that political organization was represented in Francophone Africa, in the French West Africa, which was one of the two colonial federations that France put together during colonialism for Black Africa. So Fubuanyi was going to help to put together that political movement in order to fight against colonialism. But later on, he was going somewhere to renounce to that ideal, and he was going to support France-Afrique and then the French neo-colonialism of France politics in order to divide Africa and conquer. But because he allowed the citizens of different countries to come to Ivory Coast, Ivory Coast today is a nation of, it's a melting pot. And then for many, many years, if as you're an Ivorian, wherever you will go, people will see you through the what Fubuanyi did, as Ivory Coast was the land of hospitality of all those Africans who came there. That was Fubuanyi. But of course, those who have the historical memory of Africa, they knew that he was going to be somebody who fought against Pan-Africanism in the 50s. That is Fubuanyi. Mm-hmm. Kwame Nkrumah was there. We know Kwame Nkrumah is the greatest Pan-Africanist. He contributed, to decolonize Africa. He ignited Pan-Africanism on the continent of Africa. And then later on, people, when he was overthrown, people wanted to present to Nkrumah as somebody who failed his country. But later on, his name has been rehabilitated. And then in Ghana, wherever you go in Ghana, wherever you go, when you meet somebody from Ghana, you know Kwame Nkrumah is not only the compass of Ghana, but he's the compass of Africa, and he's the compass of many people in the world who are fighting for freedom and justice. Same thing with Nelson Mandela. When I met several people in South Africa who wanted to tell us that Mandela betrayed the struggle as they were seeing all those things, I couldn't even understand how they could not see that because of what Mandela did, seen by the very people who were victimizing him as the father, because I've seen people writing that. They were talking about Mandela as the father of mankind, who became the apostle of peace and who will build like a rainbow nation and who helped avoid like a bloody civil war in South Africa. And then for Mandela's contribution to history. So when you see South African, you're going to see them in a different light because of Nelson Mandela. Even though when he was gone later on, we can see that, some South Africans will go to xenophobia, but Mandela's legacy. Today, the South African Airlines is bankrupt now, but taking the South African Airlines, they know that it represents a country flying in the skies, like in different parts of the world. That is a sense of pride that Mandela contributed to give to South Africa and to Africa. Just to mention them, I could talk about Julius Nyerere and some other leaders. So yes, that's why in the history of Africa, it is important for us to produce that moral, great political figures who can change the destiny of their respective communities and nations. And the Europeans understand that. That's why they know that they can come and destroy those who are fighting for the true interests of Africa, and then to replace them by, in the case of Burkina Faso, by Blaise Compaoré, neo-colonialist, somebody who was fighting, to promote the interests of the Europeans to the detriment of the interests of his people. Same thing in Togo when the first president of Togo, Sylvanus Olympio was killed. Somebody who could speak like more than five languages and replaced by somebody who did 9 years in elementary school who was like Yasibe Yadema. So yes, and that because they know that if they destroy our leaders, then we're going to have some difficulty to do what we have to do in this world. So it's applicable to Africa, it's applicable to the Black community in the United States with the killing of Malcolm X, the killing of Dr. King, and many other leaders. Yes, so it is important to have great leaders because they can shape history, they can change the mind, they can change the hearts, and they can accelerate the course of history.
Okay, thank you for that excellent explanation. Now, in the case of Thomas Sankara, I guess the loan situation, the loan issue, the foreign debt, that turned out to be the red line. Is that not correct?
No, I will not. I will not think. I don't. For me, so it wasn't even that, because Sankara was supposed to be gone. And many people don't see that, like, because when he came to power,
yes,
and then in 1983, and then Ufuot Boigny, the first prince of Ivory Coast, who became a very important instrument in in the new colonial policies of France in Africa,
right,
he felt threatened.
Yes.
Yeah, because people talk about the death of, that's afterwards. Before, when you felt threatened, and many people in Africa who were like the old guard, all of them, they were threatened, because I'm telling you, and then I know you too, because we belong to the same generation. So Sankara became like that light that all of us, we wanted to see in the sky of Africa when Mandela, of course, bigger, greater, was in prison.
Right.
And then Sankara became somebody that needed to be silenced or destroyed, and many other things. So in the West African Economic Community, there was a problem. There was, I think the guy was the minister, he was the head of that commission, and he stole money. And then Sankara wanted that person to go to prison. And the person was a protege of Ufuot Boigny. And Ufuot Boigny did not want the person to go to prison. There were several elements of contention between Sankara and the old guard represented by Ufuot Boigny in West Africa. And as he was enlightening the youth, I remember one day when he came to Ivory Coast, and then what we heard is that he wanted to have like a meeting to talk to the youth. Mm-hmm. Ufuot Boigny refused. You know, this is a thing that people should not know. Ufuot Boigny refused. Because
he refused to have him meet the young people in Ivory Coast because he was afraid.
He was afraid. So, and then because we were following Sankara, Sankara was changing the minds of people. So Ufuot Boigny said no. So Sankara visited Ivory Coast, but he could not have like a meeting that the president will have with the youth of the country, you know, at their request. It did not happen in the case of Sankara with Ufuot Boigny. So this alone was very sufficient for Ufuot Boigny, for Sankara to be eliminated. And now the second element, Blaise Compaoré, wanted power. And then even all the policies of austerity that Sankara was implemented, Blaise Compaoré was not in favor of that. And we know that now, because when Sankara replaced the Mercedes-Benz by Renault 405, which was like a low-level cars,
yes,
Blaise Compaoré still wanted to have a Peugeot, because a Peugeot 405 or 504, which was like a higher class, like a car that was produced by France. So he was the number two in command. Power, because when Sankara was in prison, it was Blaise Compaoré's military base that went to free Thomas Sankara.
Right.
Like in the course of the revolution that led Sankara to come to power.
Right.
So, of course, Blaise could think that he has the power to go and then have the access to state power. And Sankara himself said that if Blaise Compaoré wants, if they hear one day that Blaise Compaoré wants to do a coup against him, no one should try it and then oppose it, because there is no way anyone can even stop that coup to succeed. And this will happen. So now, when he spoke about the debt, of course, and when he met Mitterrand, of course, talking about against apartheid, there were so many, and even somebody like Gaddafi. Many people don't know that Gaddafi also was somewhat involved in the elimination of Thomas Sankara. So
really,
so
now, many people, now pause on that thought. I want you to explain that a little bit, but let me just welcome listeners that may just be tuning in now. You're listening to Black Star News Show on WBAI 99.5 FM New York and WBAI.org. And I am your host, Milton Alimari. Our guest today is Professor Naka Lagoke, and is giving us this great history of the Burkinabe experience under the leadership of Thomas Sankara. Listeners, as you know, this is listener-supported, commercial-free radio. We don't take any ads. We can only bring you these types of discussions with your support. So I do encourage you to pick up the phone and dial 212
209-2950. Any pledge you make, we will put to good use. You can also adopt Black Star News Show or any other show as a buddy. The money that you designate will be taken on a monthly basis from your credit or your debit card. You can do that by going to give and then the number 2 and then WBI.org. Now back to our guest, Professor Nakalagoke. Yes, please continue and explain, because people have a very positive image of Gaddafi in terms of his Pan-Africanism.
Gaddafi promoted Pan-Africanism. He did many great things, wanted to work on the satellite of Africans, wanted to put together the African Monetary Fund, supported the publication of the General History of Africa that was led by the UNESCO.
Right.
He did many great things, but at the same time, people have to see that Gaddafi was also involved in the destabilization of many countries.
Yes.
In Chad, for instance, mm-hmm. even in Ivory Coast, the war that was launched against Gbagbo, the civil war, mm-hmm. Gaddafi was behind it. So people have to know that.
Yes.
That in Sierra Leone, in Liberia, so all of them. So this is what was happening. So based on some credible sources that we know, like I said, Sankara became a threat.
Mm-hmm.
Gaddafi, the way he was doing things, maybe wanted to be the only leader to shine or to be that great, to be feared or admired. Sankara was there. The people loved Sankara.
Yes.
And then he was charismatic, he was eloquent, he was handsome. So, and then he has the clear vision. It was not even 40, but the level of ideological and political maturity that Sankara reached in his 30s. So, people became envious and jealous. And now, to replace Sankara by somebody like Blaise Compaoré, who seemed to advance, who wanted to be in the pockets of Gaddafi. Because right. one thing people need to know, and Dr. Mshiba spoke about that yesterday when we organized the conference, Sankara was not there to go and copy what Gaddafi was trying to do. He wanted to have his own way of implementing his vision. But if Gaddafi thought that he could replace him by somebody who was going to, who gave him the illusion or the impression that he's going to do what he wants, of course, Gaddafi would prefer Blaise Compaoré, as Blaise Compaoré and Gaddafi were going to be involved in the war in the Liberia and then in Sierra Leone. And then many other countries. Do you understand? So
instead of having two stars,
yes, what is that?
Could only be one star. Okay. So now I want you to talk a little bit about the annual conference that you host. But before you do that, I also want to ask you this other question that many listeners may be wondering: where did this Sankara come from? He was a soldier and an officer in the military. How does a soldier in the military in Africa, or an officer, have an opportunity to prepare themselves intellectually to become a Thomas Sankara? He was intellectually prepared. How did that happen? Tell us that.
I will not tell you that I know exactly how it happened. For me, maybe it would be like providence, because. I remember a story told by the testimony given by his father that when Sankara was born, then the father screamed that a captain is born. You understand? The baby. And the father already shouted that the boy was to be a captain. And the boy became a captain.
In the army.
So, and then later on, so as he was, because he has the burning fire to do something for his country, certainly gave himself, you know, he was in Madagascar, he found himself in different parts where he was going to train. And then, yes, like people like Rawlings in Ghana, they wanted something to happen and to change. And they gave themselves the means to educate themselves in order to do, and then to do what they could do when the opportunity presented itself. And then this is what they did. So this is what I will say to answer the question about how Sankara gave himself, you know, the political and ideological education for him to do what he had to do.
Right. He had an understanding of history, of
history, yes,
of political economy.
Economy at like an early age. And then if you are a Pan-Africanist and you want to change your country, you know, and then if you are serious, then you go to the, you're going to read Mandela, you're going to read this, the history of Mandela, you're going to read the Kwame Nkrumah, and then as he modeled his revolution after the Cuban Revolution, who could be at that time the greatest inspiration in the field of socialism? It was Fidel Castro, and it is a great model. So he did that. He sent some students to Cuba to go to school there. So you can. So this is what Thomas Sankara did, and that's why people revered. He's so revered in Africa. That's why people appreciate him and admire him the way they do.
Okay, very good. Now tell listeners about this annual conference that you host, including the one this past weekend, which I had the privilege of actually attending virtually as well. What do you hope to accomplish through this annual conference? And I saw that people attended virtually from all over the world. What are your objectives?
Yeah, thank you. So yes, we when I was young, I felt that my mission on Earth was to contribute to the building of my country and to the building of Africa. And then since I was young, I had the passion to read about Africa and then to contribute, to advance something that I discovered, which was called Pan-Africanism when I was in high school. We heard about Kwame Nkrumah, Sekou Touré, Thomas Sankara, and of course, Nelson Mandela, and some other Gaddafi and some other leaders. So when I came to the United States, my friends and I, we said, you know what, we need to put something together. And this is how, in 2007, we put together a Pan-African forum called the Revival of Pan-Africans Forum, because in 2007, Pan-Africanism was not the hot topic. Many people barely mentioned Pan-Africanism. And then we thought that by organizing our conferences, we could somehow contribute to revive that Pan-African dream in our space, in our community. And friends like Maurice Kani, director of the Friends of the Congo, will join us later on, 2011. The All African People's Revolution Party, Socialist Workers Party, and then Institute for Policy Studies and Pan-African Community Action, Party for Socialism and Liberation, and ENSA Coalition. Friends that we have there here, and some other friends in Europe. Amber Murray, who was teaching at Oxford University, and then many other people like Sahara reporters later on when there was the Ivory Coast crisis, and people like you, Milton Alimadi. So Black Star News. So we started organizing those Pan-African conferences. And then in 2012, we decided to put together a Thomas Sankara's conference, an annual conference, so that we can contribute to perpetuate the legacy of Thomas Sankara, so that we can play an active role in the campaign for justice for Thomas Sankara, so that we can spread the news about Thomas Sankara's vision, the same thing that we've been doing since 2007 when we decided to perpetuate the legacies of the Pan-African heroes, Henry Sylvester William, W.B. Du Bois, Marcus Garvey, and then Edward Blyden, Antonin Firmin, and many others, including Kwame Nkrumah, George Padmore, and many others. So we've been doing that since 2007, but we realized that maybe the time has come for us, to shed some light on the contribution of somebody that people want to erase, from the history books in Burkina Faso. So we've been doing that every year, and then we saw the movement growing. And then so this year, we decided to do that conference in order to talk about the Thomas Sankara's legacy and then to shed some lights on the campaign for justice for Thomas Sankara. We did not know that people were going to start the trial on October 11. So
yes,
when
Professor Langoka, I'm glad you brought that, because that was going to be the final question, actually. I wanted to say there's an ongoing trial right now in Burkina Faso of some of the suspects involved
in his brutal murder, October 15, 1987. However, the key suspect, Blaise Compaoré, who was his right-hand man, is not amongst those suspects being tried now. So tell listeners, where is Blaise Compaoré? Tell us how this trial is proceeding and what outcome do we hope? But unfortunately, we only have 5 minutes left. So
no, it's perfect. I'm going to talk about that in 3 minutes. So yes, Blaise Compaoré, who was the major suspect in Sankara's assassination, is in Ivory Coast, my country of origin. His wife is from Ivory Coast, and that was the lady through whom Ufuboyi had found a way to, somehow to destroy the revolution in Burkina Faso. And then Blaise Compaoré he decided to take the Ivory Coast citizenship, and then using that in order to refuse to go, and then go to Burkina Faso, to the court system over there in Burkina. But now, when Sankara died, Blaise Compaoré and many other people said that Sankara died of natural death. They even put that in the birth certificate. So we want justice for Thomas Sankara, and many people, like many other people in the world. So we did that, and that's why it is important. And then, so the same way Babo's trial in Ivory Coast was going to become a very important moment, like in the Pan-African struggle, because many people across the globe mobilized for Babolora in the name of Pan-Africanism and in the name of internationalism and justice and freedom. That is the same way that we thought that around the trial of the killers of Thomas Sankara, we can mobilize, organize, talk about Thomas Sankara's legacy, talk about Pan-Africanism, and we want justice for Thomas Sankara.
How many people are on trial for his murder?
I think 14 people are on trial, and Blaise Compaoré is one of them. He certainly is going to be condemned in absentia. And then Jean Jere, who was the head of the special forces of Blaise Compaoré, who tried to do a counter coup in 2015, who did not succeed, is one of them, and there are some other ones.
And there's no chance that Blaise Compaoré will be extradited to Burkina.
The only thing is that if there is a change of regime in Ivory Coast, and the people who may take over can extradite him. But if not, he supported Alassane Ouattara. He sheltered the rebellion. We need to remember that against Babu. And then the rebellion that he supported was the beneficiary was Alassane Ouattara, who came to power. So there is no way Alassane Ouattara is going to let Blaise Compaoré be extradited.
Professor Langoke, you spoke about a remarkable man today, a man who goes to another African country and is blocked from speaking to the youth. Just imagine that concept, you know?
Yeah, definitely. Yeah, that's a very important, that's a piece of information. So yes, I wanted to share. Thank you for giving me the opportunity to talk about that, because Sankara was he's a great Pan-Africanist, and yes, so thank you very much.
Obviously, there was a fear that he might spark a revolution.
Yep, and then Sankara himself said it. That's something. Thank you. Sankara himself said it, that it's not only Burkina Faso that needs a revolution. He said even the surrounding, the neighboring countries, the neighboring countries, all of them need a revolution. And then responded and said, no, that we don't need a revolution, but we need evolution. So that was that debate. So it was serious. So he wanted to spread it in West Africa, and then that's why he has to be gone.
You were speaking too much truth to power. Professor, tell listeners how they can get in touch with you. I'm sure there are many listeners listening to you right now who want to engage you in conversation. Tell them how they can reach you.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, thank you. My name is Nyaka Lagoke, and then nyakalagoke@gmail.com. That should be the best way, for people to...
You probably want to spell it for listeners.
Yeah, but GNAKALAGOKE@gmail.com.
Thank you so much. And next year, of course, we will give promotion to the annual conference way in advance, and hopefully we can get more people to attend. Remain Pan-African listeners, and please follow me at Ali Mahdi on Twitter, and also go to blackstarnews.com. That is all the time we have with our
phenomenal guest today. We will have him back in a couple of weeks to give us an update. Thank you, listeners. Stay strong. Stay pan-African.
Thank you. Thank you very much, Minton.
It's 2000 Black. Yes. And, of course, we're hoping that by the year 2000, we know that by the year 2000, that's even better, everybody will be knowledgeable. You understand? Everybody Black. 2000 Black. 2000 Black. 2000 Black. 2000 Black. 2000 Black. 2000 Black.
Greetings, sisters and brothers. Welcome to the remaining time that we have on Black Star News Show today. I am your host, Milton Alimadi, and we're on 99.5 FM, New York, WBAI, and also streaming on WBAI.org. Listeners, as I reminded you earlier in this program, we are listener-supported, 100% commercial-free, no advertising. That is why we can speak truth to power. So remember to support WBAI. And in this remaining time we have, we're going to be having a discussion about the Black Alliance for Peace. And Gus Griffin is a member of the Africa team of the Black Alliance for Peace. He's also an activist with the Archie Elliott the Third Coalition for Justice, as well as a member of the Ujima People's Progressive Party. And he'll tell us a little bit about the BAP, about the Archie Elliott, the Third Coalition for Justice, as well as the Ujima People's Progressive Party in the course of our discussion. Welcome to Black Star News Show, Gus Griffin.
Thank you for having me.
All right, so let's get straight to it. Black Alliance for Peace, I know your organization has been doing a lot of work focusing on Africa and Africa's activities on the African continent and the role it's playing in a lot of the destabilization and conflict that is ongoing in the continent. So briefly, for listeners that are not familiar with the Black Alliance for Peace, please tell us how long it's been operating and what you guys do and how people can become involved in the Black Alliance for Peace.
Sure. Black Alliance for Peace was initiated in 2017 as a counterweight to a great deal certainly in a significant part to counterweight what AFRICOM has been on the continent. We are anti-capitalist. We are anti-imperialist, anti-patriarchy, anti-supremacist, anti racism, and we are here to try to first educate, but also to offer alternative ideas, alternative ideological thinking to the status quo of the neoliberal status quo. And one of the primary campaigns we have right now is, of course, getting AFRICOM out of Africa, which this month marks the 13-year anniversary of AFRICOM. Which is United States military operations all across the African continent. And the purpose of AFRICOM is to use U.S. military power to impose U.S. control of African land, resources, labor, et cetera, and the needs of U.S. multinational corporations and the wealthy in the United States. It has nothing to do with the prescribed agenda of being anti-terrorist. In fact, one can make the very, very clear case that it has been more responsible for a great deal of that kind of activity more than combating it. So that's what we're about. This month, we've chosen to take this month of this 13th year anniversary to really ratchet up our educational efforts through teach-ins and conversations through mediums like your own, which we're very grateful for, in an effort to raise the consciousness about it. We can't count on corporate media, as I'm sure many of your listeners know. And so we've got to offer it ourselves. And this is one of the things that we're trying to do this month in particular. But even beyond.
All right. So now many listeners are actually a little confused because many believe that AFRICOM does not really exist because there's no base for AFRICOM on the African continent. So what do we mean when we're talking about AFRICOM when, in fact, AFRICOM does not exist? Tell listeners why they're completely wrong and why AFRICOM does, in fact, exist and how it exists. And then give us some examples of some of the destructive destabilization that AFRICOM has actually been involved in.
Great question. And I think that's, you just sort of touched on one of the primary reasons for this campaign. Through corporate media, by and large, I think the reason why a lot of people are confused is because if you hear anything about foreign entities in Africa, it's typically China. And typically that's sort of the anti-China new Cold War propaganda that is put forth. And certainly China is active on the continent, but its activity is much more distinct from that of U.S. AFRICOM and military activities. Most of China's activities are through what they call the Belt and Road Initiative, in which they're actually investing in a great deal of infrastructure. Now, that doesn't mean China is exempt from any criticism. That, you know, we can have that discussion at another time. But to conflate it with what AFRICOM is doing, which is military endeavors across the continent, drone strikes and essentially extrajudicial killings in the name of anti-terrorism is drastically different. And so whenever I hear I'm in certain different groups, social media groups where folks who tend to retire in Africa or study abroad groups, and whenever I hear a foreign interest in Africa, it's almost always about China and it's usually negative. And so I try to push back as much as possible. And frankly, the common response is they didn't even know about it. Just as you mentioned, they didn't even know that AFRICOM exists on the continent. And so that's what we're trying to do. And we, during this month, we have a number of teach-ins where we're trying to get the word out, as you say. But we know we have to do it through mediums like your own. We have to do it through alternative mediums because you're not going to get it through corporate media, which is essentially just the PR firm or the PR arm of U.S. imperialism. That's the only way you can put it, because you're just not going to hear about it that way. So that's what we're trying to do. Again, the drone strikes throughout the continent have been, it's really an indictment on any media that hasn't talked about this because it's been going on forever. And or not, I wouldn't say forever, but I mean, it's been going on for a great deal of time at this point. And it can only be through intentional non-reporting that it hasn't been talked about before. So that's what we're trying to do.
I think it's important, though, to challenge that. I mean, we hear everything about, well, if there's a drone strike in Afghanistan, Yemen, Pakistan, we always get the details. We find out about how many people were killed, whether civilians were killed by those strikes. And yet, indeed, as you pointed out, there have been drone strikes in Somalia, in many parts of North Africa, and we never hear about this. Have you ever challenged corporate media and saying, listen, this is not really something you can pick and choose. You don't have the right to make that determination unless you're making a declarative statement that the lives of Africans really don't count. And let them respond to that. Have you tried to challenge that them in that way?
Well, we do it all the time. However, frankly, if your perspective is not within a certain canon, they don't really want to hear you. And that's just the reality of you. It's hard to get space in those places, so to speak. Right. And in addition to corporate media, I don't want to just lay it on them. They've certainly been culpable. But also, right. When we look through, we've done some research on bills that have funded AFRICOM. And we took a look at about six of them over the last X amount of years. And frankly, the process for approving them, and they're related to the Pentagon, is pretty much a rubber stamp process. Mm-hmm. Pretty much rubber stamp. Very few people ever resist, including the Congressional Black Caucus, I'm afraid to say. As we looked at about half a dozen different bills, and we found that the Congressional Black Caucus approves these bills at about a 70% clip. 70%. So I think part of the issue, part of the education piece that you spoke of is that We think we have a check in Congress. We think we have a check, most of us, primarily through the Democratic Party. And it just doesn't exist. It's just not there. They simply don't check them on that issue very much. And then there are other issues, but that's one of the issues that is just on a skateboard, and it's going straight through, and it's not going to get it's going to get very little, if any, resistance, but be it in the Senate or the House.
What about our own other outlets like Black media, Black-owned media, Black-owned newspapers, Black-owned news websites?
Well, I'd like to say, again, you're in the there are a few, but not as much as we would like. And I think, and part of that is, frankly, the money that they get it's essentially hush money in terms of some advertising, things of that nature. And I'll give you an example. There was a local example, but there was a bill here in the Washington area called Proposition 70, and it was geared at raising the salaries of restaurant workers and hospitality workers. It right. passed by 56%, which is not a small measure, 56%. The D.C. council threw it out. They threw it out. And it's perfectly legal for them to do that, but it's very rare. They just threw it out because the lobby, restaurant industry lobby is so strong, and they put so much money into a lot of the local Black media outlets that their narrative was pretty much against it. And that's very confusing for a lot of people. And so that's just an example of how that works. And it works that way on a local level, works that way on an international level. And it's very difficult to challenge a lot of these narratives when you don't have any space in corporate media because they reach the most people. But we're going to continue to struggle. We understand it's an ongoing struggle, long range struggle. And so that's what a lot of what we're doing this month is all about.
All right. So tell listeners some of the campaigns that Black Alliance for Peace has been involved in that you would consider has had the most impact in terms of pushing against AFRICOM, or at least raising the profile of your organization and letting more people know about the work you're involved in?
Well, there are a number of them. I think we've done a lot of wonderful work on the issue in Haiti and raising awareness. I think if you'd asked a lot of folks before the elections a couple of years last year, who would you want, Biden or Trump? If you'd ask a lot of folks who are in this country who are from Haiti or Haitian migrants, who would you want, Biden or Trump? I think a great deal, many of them might have said, we'd rather have Biden. But if you look at what's happened along the border in recent weeks, it's clear you can't tell one from the other. Now, you can't tell one from the other in terms of the outcomes, in terms of how they're treated. And we find that that's more consistent than people believe. And that the differences are more tactical and stylistic than they are substantive. And so we think we've had some success in pushing against that narrative and pointing that out. Also in terms of the Afghanistan process and the whole piece there, I think sometimes people get this sense that, well, we're Black Alliance for Peace, so we're only interested in Africa. And that's not true. Certainly that's our primary interest, but that's not true. We are interested in all humanity and all particularly working people. And so we push back on those issues as well. We've tried to outline the contradictions in U.S. foreign policy and also looked at how what happens in the foreign industry, in the foreign theater, also happens back home. And in this case, domestically, it would be in the form of what we call the 1033 program, in which excess military equipment is distributed to domestic police stations. And then that's used on, and it shouldn't be very much of a mystery who that's used on. And so that we think we've had some success in those areas. We certainly have a lot further to go, but we do believe we're going in the right direction.
All right. Now, the other issue, of course, is when you have some of these neo-colonial rulers in African countries. You have General Museveni in Uganda. You have General Kagame in Rwanda. You have the leadership in South Sudan with Salva Kiir. And most of these are people that invite United States troops to actually station
in their countries. This is obviously a problem. And how do you deal with this in terms of engaging and challenging these neocolonial leaders who are actually kind of inviting the presence of Africa through the back door, sort of?
Well, I think there's a phrase that, you know, and I'm paraphrasing, same skin ain't your can, so to speak. So I think kind of highlighting that, and folks understand that here, you know, you highlight it and you talk about it. The same is true on the international level. You know, there've always been, I guess the phrase would be the Comprador class. There've always been people who have basically acted against the masses of the people's own interests. It's not new. It's a more sophisticated form, I think, in these days than in previous days. You know, Nkrumah referred to it as, you know, neocolonialism. And I think that book is a very good book to read to kind of understand that. And so, again, this is a massive education, you know, endeavor that we're on. And it's not going to happen overnight. It didn't get this way overnight. Not going to happen. Not going to change overnight. And so we just keep pushing in those areas and trying to highlight those contradictions. And when you do and point it out, I think we got people listening. We have people listening. And I don't even know X amount of years ago if we, you know, really had as many people listening as we do now. I think people are seeing and looking at the existing systems, both internationally, domestically, and across the board. And they're seeing that these systems aren't working. And certainly COVID-19 exposed a lot of these systems that they're not working. So then the question becomes, what alternatives do you have? And those are the things that we're working on. Alternative ideas, but also substantive, concrete alternative systems, i.e. mutual aid, worker cooperatives, things of that nature, that give people a different way of looking at this. Because ultimately, your behavior follows your thinking.
Consciousness, absolutely. Listeners, if you're just tuning in, you're listening to Black Star News Show on WBAI 99.5 FM radio, also streaming on WBAI.org. And I am your host, Milton Alimadi. Our guest is Gus Griffin, and he's a member of the Black Alliance for Peace. Specifically, he's on the Africa team, and he's talking about how the organization has been challenging AFRICOM and its destructive presence on the African continent. Listeners, I need not remind you, we are 100% listener supported. So we depend on your support. And at this time, I would like to remind you, pick up the phone and dial 212-209-2950. Any donations will be put to good use. You can also adopt Black Star News Show or any other show as a buddy, in which case the money is taken out that you designate on a monthly basis from your credit or debit card. You can do that by going to give, and then the number 2, and then WBAI.org. Now, in the concluding time, the concluding minutes that we have, Gus Griffin, please tell listeners that are interested in becoming a part of Black Alliance for Peace and becoming involved in some of these campaigns and activities, what they need to do, how they can get in touch with you, or how they can join the organization.
Okay. First thing I'd say is visit the Black Alliance for Peace website. You can do that, www.blackalliance.com. But we also have, what you'll find there is a toolkit for Shut Down AFRICOM, and that's geared specifically to this campaign, but you'll also get information on how you can join. We're growing very fast. And so that's the good news. But we also have allies. For example, the U.S. Out of Africa Network is our organizational arm that's working on this specific campaign. But even if you don't join the Black Alliance for Peace, and we certainly welcome you, join a local organization that is geared towards working towards the things that are important to you. I'm a member of the UGMA Party here in Maryland, UGMA People's Progress Party, and we're Maryland's first Black worker-led party. We're trying to get on the ballot to give people an alternative. So, we don't dictate to you what organization you join, but join an organization, because ultimately it's going to take a lot of organization to push back against it. There's a phrase that, you know, there's organized money and there's organized people.
Yes.
And you got to know that you're not part of the money part. So there's only one other place for you to go.
All right. Thank you so much, Gus Griffin. We will definitely have you back in a couple of weeks to give us an update on some of your activities. Thank you so much. That's all the time we have, listeners. You can follow me at Ali Mahdi on Twitter. Please also go to blackstarnews.com. Remain Pan-African, and we will see you next week. Thank you.
Washington and WBAI in New York. I'm Amara Evering with some brief news headlines. City officials in New York City voted unanimously to remove the Thomas Jefferson statue in the council chambers because of his legacy and his history as a slaveholder. Despite his publicized views on religious freedom and separation of church and state, Jefferson believed that people of African descent were biologically inferior to whites and could never live alongside them as equals. For two decades, Black and Latino council members called for the statue to be taken down from chambers and relocated to the New York Historical Society. The New York Historical Society has agreed to display the statue in a way that captures Jefferson's legacy as a founding father, but also as a man who enslaved more than 600 people and fathered six children with Sally Hemings, who he enslaved. This has reignited a conversation over what historical figures we look at as symbols of systematic racism and oppression, and do we consider the, quote, founding fathers in the same vein? In two unsigned opinions on Monday, the Supreme Court ruled in favor of police officers seeking qualified immunity from allegations of excessive force. Qualified immunity is a controversial legal doctrine that shields law enforcement from liability for some constitutional violations. Calls for the court to take a substantial new look at the new doctrine intensified after the killing of George Floyd in 2020. The doctrine requires plaintiffs to not only show that the official accused of misconduct violated a constitutional right, but also that the right had been, quote, clearly established in a previous ruling. Advocates argue that the doctrine creates a catch-22 because it requires a previous ruling, but denies plaintiffs an opportunity to set a precedent for the next victim. Yesterday's rulings are a major setback for the campaign to rein in qualified immunity and a clear signal that a majority of the court remains eager to protect violent officers from accountability. The House Select Committee investigating the January 6th Capitol insurrection is expected to vote tonight to hold former Trump White House aide Steve Bannon in contempt of Congress for his refusal to comply with its subpoena. If convicted, Bannon faces the possibility of up to a year in prison. Bannon is arguing that he is protected by executive privilege, but the committee appears to be dismissing that claim. In a tweet yesterday, Democratic Congressman Jamie Raskin, a member of the Select Committee and a former constitutional law professor, insisted the former Trump advisor has no right to defy a subpoena. saying the idea that executive privilege would shield a private citizen from turning over evidence about a violent insurrection against the government because he knows a twice impeached former president is farcical and insulting. Get with it, Steve. If the contempt citation is approved tonight, it will go to the House for a vote. If the House approves the charge, a criminal referral will be made to the Justice Department. Amazon executives, including Jeff Bezos, may have misled Congress and lied under oath, according to a letter from a